Welcome to Federal Insights, sponsored by Akamai. Here's today's moderator, Tom Temin.
Each year brings a new cybersecurity challenge for federal agencies. But for the last couple of years, they've had a sort of North Star to work towards, namely zero trust architecture. For how a large multi-component department is approaching cybersecurity and zero trust, I spoke with the Chief Information Security Officer of the Health and Human Services Department, Lamont Yarborough. Well, let's begin with a review of HHS cybersecurity activities, which is a very big topic, but it can give us at least the, I don't want the 50,000 foot view, I want the 5,000 foot view.
Well, of course, we're doing all manner of things with respect to security within our agency. Of course, we're a pretty large federated agency comprised of a number of entities with discrete mission sets. So their considerations, their cyber considerations, their risk acceptance considerations may differ from operational division to operational division. But what's prominent and foremost with respect to what we do, we want to ensure that, you know, we're tracking against those things that assail us. And we do that via a number of ways and mechanisms. Of course, historical knowledge of, you know, compromises to the extent that we've had any things, security events. We leverage that information to kind of inform where we might be vulnerable or where we might need to better refine our ability to counter. With that, overarchingly, and, you know, within our agency and others as well, is, you know, the zero trust paradigm. We're all moving towards that outcome. It's non-trivial, to say the least. It requires the diligence of everyone pretty much on a daily basis to discern from a strategy perspective how we approach it. And I think we are doing, you know, really well in that area. So zero trust is one. Perhaps SCRM security, supply chain risk management is another one. We want to ensure that, you know, we're using software and other capabilities, even hardware to some extent, to make sure that there's not built-in security compromises that we can identify from manufacturing to implementation, right? So we want to reconcile those. We want to ensure that, you know, we're weighing against our legacy technologies to ensure that they're still, while they remain in service to the extent that they are, that they're capable of being patched appropriately, being updated appropriately, and even discerning to the extent, going back to the zero trust I was referring to, whether they can handle transforming into a zero trust paradigm. So we're trying to do a number of things.
Yes, and you mentioned too how federated HHS is, and some of the federated pieces are pretty darn big. They would be large agencies by themselves if you look at NIH and CDC and FDA and on and on. So as the Chief Information Security Officer, do you have simply moral authority over those entities, or how does it work in the governance standpoint? You can't tell CDC what to do in particular detail, maybe, but you've got some kind of a shared vision, I imagine.
Sure. As the head, for lack of a better term, security executive, you know, representing the agency, yes, I can intervene to the extent if something is improper, if I could put it that way. By and large, that's never the case. If I'm
like, if they did away with passwords, you'd probably say, hey, wait a minute, you can't do that.
Exactly. So there are, I guess, there are guidelines that we publish from an agency perspective that hopefully informs their direction irrespective of wherever they lie, to the extent that they devise practices and guidelines within their own paradigm. I'm fine with that because, again, they have to discern their risk at the tactical level, at the operational level. And I have every confidence in the respective CISOs over those organizations that are doing the right thing. We're always in constant communication. So there's never been a scenario where I had to reach out and say, you might want to rethink this. Because in fact, when they're making policy considerations that they even remotely think might be problematic or maybe something I would need to know more of, they'll reach out to me first.
Sure. Interesting. And they probably have their own issues. If you look at an NIH, you know, can the National Cancer Institute tell infectious diseases what to do?
Exactly.
And so on. Well, let's talk about zero trust. That's on everybody's agenda in some form or another. It's a state to get to. And I guess in some ways it's a continuous, never-ending thing to have zero trust. Tell us about your zero trust journey, where you are, and what you anticipate, you know, coming in the near future.
Okay, great question. And I should say up front that depending on the time of day, I might give somewhat of a different answer. It's a constant, dynamic kind of activity. when we hear that term, I try to disabuse people of this notion that we're starting from scratch and trying to build towards something, because to me, zero trust in a lot of ways is a compilation of a lot of discrete activities that were being done already in some facet or form. Now the exercise in my mind is to try to discern or evaluate how mature those processes are, and figuring out a way by which you can coalesce them in a manner that you could reasonably define as a zero trust architecture. That involves a lot of things, again, going back to our federated nature and the discrete activities within each operational division. But however, there are basic tenets and milestones that are clearly articulated depending on who you refer to. We refer to the CISA model. I'm sure if you're DOD, you might refer to the DOD model. But nonetheless, that helps us from a roadmap perspective to kind of, for one, evaluate and assess where we are individually, again, back to an operational division perspective, and then evaluate the types of resources that we need to apply to move the dial, so to speak. And so the operational divisions do that discreetly, but at the same time, we get together frequently and we kind of go over scar tissue, lessons learned, et cetera. And we get the opportunity to identify any particular pain points that we could help each other out in moving forward.
And what are the milestones you use to measure whether you're getting toward zero trust?
There are a number of milestones. So we went through this vast exercise that we challenged all of our partners within the agency to do, and system by system, kind of identifying each system where they are with respect to all the facets within the zero trust model. We had them put it on paper, Excel sheets, actually. It was a painstaking process for each particular system. And we took the opportunity to kind of assess that information. And from that, we kind of devised a maturity model, if you will, with respect to how we stand organizationally as an enterprise and how each operational division stands independently. And we talk about it. We get together and we identify where a particular system might be suffering in the particular model, be it if it's identity and so on and so forth through the respective pillars. And then we try to craft and devise ways that we can get things moving. And of course, through that exercise, it also allows us to discern whether we're not making advancements in a particular system or area because of resources, whether it's a lack of personnel, whether it's a lack of funding. That data is helpful for us because then we can begin to have the conversations on where we're going to get those resources, and we can make the respective appeals to those who could potentially provide us those resources.
And a lot of agencies look at zero trust, or a lot of people that are doing zero trust look at it in terms of two basic buckets that have to have zero trust. One is your human users and their devices, and the other is all of the things besides the human users, the bots, the AI algorithms, the machine calls from one application to another, the information sharing and data requests that originate sometimes automatically from application to application. That's getting more complicated with digital services. So talk about first the human side of it, ensuring zero trust beyond just the password for users.
Sure. I think along this journey, we're going to have to expect or provide some level of training, because I think zero trust as a paradigm is also a mindset, right? We're accustomed to doing things in certain ways. We're accustomed to having access in the ways that we have them now. And they may change somewhat at the end of this journey. So it's not only the technical things that we implement. It's not only, you know, the logical things that we implement, but it's our mindset, our perspective, right? So some user education is going to be applicable to this scenario.
Right. That is to say, they might have a biometric added to the way they log on, for example.
Sure. And just from an expectation perspective, right? Because along the identity piece and the user piece, et cetera, the data piece is just as critical, right? The governance strategy that we put beside how we access data and leverage data will be just as critically important to any other of the pillars.
Because in some sense, everybody already had zero trust for users, for human users, because everyone's had to have a password since time immemorial.
Sure.
That's zero trust in some sense.
Sure. Yes and no. I think it's going to be more compartmentalized. It won't be as reliant as, for instance, having a VPN in a particular environment. It won't be so reliant as once you're authenticated within a particular environment that you're free to roam about the country, so to speak. It's going to be more compartmentalized to discern whether it's appropriate for you to have access to certain spaces or certain data.
Right. For example, if someone is going to the opposite coast from where they normally work, the system knows that. It can tell the geographic location. That might be a clue to invoke some secondary measure of challenge for that particular user, because normally they work in Atlanta. What are they doing in Montreal or something?
Perhaps. Depending on how you tune things, that could certainly be a consideration.
And are you looking at the multi-factor specifically?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I see somewhere in this journey less reliance on PIV authentication and other facets, FIDO, et cetera, and other technologies I envision being the end state.
And I guess along with that, then people are thinking about how to do this and implement these more sophisticated technologies than password 1234, but not make people crazy.
Absolutely. Because at the end of the day, sure, we want things to be protected, but you can't, you know, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir. You can't secure things in a way that you simply can't get anything done, right? So you have to weigh the risks and the pros and cons of one solution versus another.
And just what's your process if you're going to try something and say, this is the technique, this is the product we think can give us what we want in terms of user authentication. But at HHS, you have to know that's going to really scale too, because you're not a 27-person agency.
Sure. You pilot it, as with any other technology you're thinking of using, right? So you use a small sample size and you make that technology available and you see what the reaction is. You give people an opportunity to kind of beat it up, so to speak. And so you can identify any weaknesses or any weaknesses that you are not willing to accept or any weaknesses that you can fortify to minimize their ability to destroy.
Lamont Yarborough, Chief Information Security Officer of the Health and Human Services Department. We'll return with more of the interview after the short break. I'm Tom Temin.
Hi, I'm Mike Richmond of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Did you know veterans enrolled in VA healthcare can use over 4,000 urgent care locations across the country to treat non-life-threatening conditions? It's easy and free. Just show your veteran health ID card. Sign up at va.gov, call 1-800-MY-VA-411, or visit your nearest VA medical center. I'm Mike Richmond.
Welcome back to our interview with Lamont Yarborough, Chief Information Security Officer of the Health and Human Services Department. I'm Tom Temin. Our topic is cybersecurity and HHS's progress toward zero trust. And before the break, we were talking about ways of updating security and access for the human entities. But probably the more difficult and subtle thing is to get zero trust for those that are non-human entities. That's where the growth really is. You're not going to be adding 100,000 employees, but you could be adding 1 million bots, you know, for data sharing and CDC and talking to NIH about pandemics and so forth. So talk about some of the milestones and technology approaches you anticipate for zero trust for non-human entities?
Well, of course, we're doing our best to first fully appreciate the capacity of AI and ML technologies, right? Of course, these technologies have existed for a while. Now they exist in a way that perhaps they're on steroids, pretty much. So we're trying to understand their capacity, their ability to help us do our work. And we're still doing that discovery process or assessment on how available do we make these technologies, maybe not just to our technical folks, but to our everyday users? And what guardrails are we going to implement to ensure that we can minimize the ability to do harm, right? Notwithstanding with AI, if you've been following, I believe there's an AI technology being sued right now for stealing IP. Intellectual property or copyright infringement of some sort. So that's a big piece in my mind, because everyone potentially could make a claim that, you know, you're taking my information, that you're not paying for my expertise or for my intellectual property, et cetera. So that's going to be a meaningful outcome, I think, in trying to help inform how we might leverage this technology in a way that doesn't violate these copyrights and intellectual property rights and all those things. But that notwithstanding, IP and ML and by extension are very powerful technologies that can better the way that we do things. But conversely, in the hands of the wrong people, and a lot of the wrong people have access, we have to be mindful of what we can do to defend ourselves from those who will come after us leveraging those technologies.
Yes, because zero trust presumes that those nefarious bots, the ones that wish you ill, that want to steal data, are already on your network.
Sure.
And so therefore they can't do what they want to do because of zero trust. So how do you think about what are some of the techniques you're looking at to make sure that really is the state?
Well, I think at a high level, first and foremost, your ability to monitor your environment, irrespective of the vector, is critically important, right? Specifically, if you're a sophisticated organization such as HHS is, you know, constant monitoring, looking for anomalies, risk detection strategies, those activities will always be critical in helping to discern, you know, where your pain points are, to include bots or any other technology for that matter.
All right. And what about network segmentation? Are you looking at that and some of those
network
things?
Network segmentation is part and parcel of a zero trust architecture. That's an inherent part of it. So, yes, we are considering that as well, discreetly, again, at an operational division level. But we want to ensure that from a baseline perspective, there's a minimum standard by which each entity within the agency meets that outcome.
Yeah, because that's something that happens. No one can segment and network by hand. It's a tool set, and it's a status of the network that you really have to derive from observation tools, but it's not something you can watch
right
segment by segment. There's millions of segments.
Exactly.
And therefore, the role of the network operations center or maybe the security operations center would change, I imagine.
Somewhat. And we would have to adapt so that it's capable of responding in the fashion necessary to appreciate the new end state that we would be in at the end of this zero trust journey.
And what are the human capital sides of this, both for the people you need, well, mainly for the people you need in the security and cybersecurity CISO channel,
right,
of employee?
Agency-wide, I think we have some 5,000-plus cybersecurity professionals. So that's the good part. The challenge, going back to this notion of zero trust capabilities already being there on form or facet, is the perspective that we view this paradigm. People who do the same thing every day within the cybersecurity sphere look at it through a particular lens. It might be hard to see the forest for the trees, if you will. You have to truly think differently in some ways to fully appreciate this new concept, right? And that might require some external eyes to come in and help facilitate our direction. Perhaps it will, perhaps it won't, but I think it would be a good idea to make room for the possibility of perhaps leveraging external talent who comes in without a particular bias to the environment that these operators have operated in for years, just to make sure that the perspective is accurate with respect to where we need to go from an end state perspective. Because if I'm looking, you know, I might come, like, for instance, we're in your office and you have a number of figures in your office.
Bobbleheads.
Okay. Yes. Well, okay. Bobbleheads. And you might walk in one day and not appreciate that someone actually came in and took one, because you expect all of them to be there. And in your mind, it's already registering to you that all of your bobbleheads are there. But somebody says, I'm going to play a trick on you and I'm going to go and steal one. And you may not ever notice it, but yet you're here every day, right? That kind of thing, right?
I want to make sure Ryan Zimmerman is still up there while we're actually having this discussion. So you wouldn't necessarily go to full government-owned, contractor-operated mode for the SOX, but maybe just a little external review.
Well, by and large, from an enterprise perspective, we have an in-house SOC mm-hmm. capability. By and large, most of the operating divisions do themselves. Some may have, you know, went offshore to leverage some SOC capability, but by and large, we're pretty mature from a SOC perspective.
And getting back to that question of federation, and I'm just the three big pieces that come to mind, FDA, CDC, NIH, very often they do collaborate. You know, if there's a health outbreak of some sort, you know, they need, for that matter, they collaborate outside of HHS. You know, FEMA might come into something or whatever, different elements of the government. How do you ensure that everyone, with respect to zero trust and knowing simply that they're secure, is at least at the minimum baseline level, such that when there is collaboration and data sharing, one is not compromising everybody else?
That's an interesting question, because it supposes that in the course of these levels of coordination, that it's also going to include some intermingling of systems, right? And there's already a practice for that. It's called an interconnection security agreement, where it kind of articulates on the respective sides each level of security maturity for each of the opposing systems, if you will. So there's already a practice for that. And each official who's authorized to approve that interconnection gets to evaluate the security maturity of the other system.
Right. So in other words, I'm bringing the Gatorade powder, you're bringing the water. I have to know that water has no bacteria.
Absolutely.
And you have to know my Gatorade powder has no mold.
Right. So you show me your lab results that indicates that this water is free of contaminants. Right.
And how does the cloud complicate or figure into the zero trust idea? Because you are ultimately responsible for your applications and data, whether they're in a HHS data center or in a cloud service provider.
Sure.
And yet the cloud is predicated on the fact that we are secure in what we offer government customers.
Right. Commonly, when you leverage an external provider to provide some level of service for you, specifically with the risks involved in it, it's typically called risk transferral. And
risk transference, that was Freud.
Yeah. But in the security mindset, is risk transference. I think there used to be a behavior where when you would transfer that risk to a third party, that you somehow behaved as though you're not overall still accountable for that risk. So risk transference is a mechanism where you make someone else responsible, but you are still overall accountable. So from that perspective, it requires a certain level of understanding of the behavior of the cloud service provider. It requires being very specific in contract language and service level agreements with respect to the behavior of the cloud service provider when things go wrong, and the standard expected in their participation and collaboration to explore or discover what went wrong in those activities. So by and large, the proof is in, or the devil's in the details with respect to the contract language.
And in your day-to-day work, do you find that you have upper executive level management interest? I mean, does Xavier ever call and say, hey, it's Xavier. Lamont, how are we doing on cyber today? Do I have anything to worry about?
I'm sure the secretary is always interested in the goings-on, specifically because of our sector, you know, public health and healthcare. Bad actors always take the opportunity to assail us in whatever fashion that they can and steal data and steal personally identifiable information. But no, I don't get direct calls from the secretary, but I'm sure there are folks acting on his behalf to understand what's going on.
But you do feel the sense of executive sponsorship for the CISO activities?
Without question.
Lamont Yarborough, Chief Information Security Officer of the Health and Human Services Department. To hear this interview again or share it with colleagues, please visit federalnewsnetwork.com and search Insights. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Federal Insights, sponsored by Akamai on Federal News Network.